Hi, Kevin. How are you?
Hey, Owen. Well, isn't it an interesting world we're living in these days?
It's historic times. I mean, I've said it before, but it's every day something new seems to crop up. It's absolutely fascinating, isn't it? What's the news where you are?
Well, it's all a playing out of what's going on in a big sense. We've had confirmation recently that Trudeau has definitely formally ceded over the West Coast to China, that China is now operating as the de facto legal power there, operating under their own laws, especially in these protected enclaves around the superport, Prince Rupert,
So when you
which
say
we mentioned
formally,
before.
how do you mean formally? Is
An agreement. This is a signed agreement. But like with most agreements and laws in Canada, they're never made public. They're done order in council.
I just saw him in a photo with the Queen. Has he come over here to shake hands with the Queen just recently to seek her approval? Or is that from way
Well,
back?
it wouldn't surprise me because it like I mentioned, the big picture here is that using the destruction in the Ukraine to keep America occupied there, China is moving in a big way to grab British Columbia as a base of operations to take the whole continent. Because the main opposition China faced in the world was from America, not Russia, who's kind of a junior partner. And the way to get them now is to distract their attention and make the move now. So this heralds a complete takeover bid by China. Russia will assist them for now. China knew that Russia was in a weaker position than them economically and other ways. And frankly, I think that NATO was provoked by China to go into the Ukraine in order to provoke Putin to attack, because they know exactly the psychology and the history of Russia is you don't mess around on their border and not expect a reaction. So that suits China's agenda very well. Behind that smokescreen, they're taking over. Now, don't forget that the China system, Chinese government and political economic system, is totally adapted to the corporatocracy. It's the kind of system they want. So, that people say, well, why in the middle of this COVID thing is a war breaking out? It helps the corporatocracy. It not only helps the bankers and the oil companies and everything, but it's helping solidify that global oligarchy. And China will be the leading actor in that for a long time, maybe for centuries.
It seems to me that there's two tiers, right? We've got that international, perhaps continental, very much like 1984, George Orwell's book, where he's looking at Eurasia, Oceania, but the level up is the level of what researchers call the cult, right? Or that overseeing network. I was listening to Harry Vox. I don't know if you know him, but he talks about the Israeli Jewish Zionist banking cartel that's running the whole thing via BlackRock and Vanguard. And so it's basically the network or the cult fighting itself to a certain extent. I mean, I was obviously using the pawns of the people to do so, but is it because the West has, to a certain extent, gathered some momentum on a wake up, and so there's this, from a corporate global perspective, the headquarters is looking to attack the wake up area region, and so areas such as Canada, Australia, and Ukraine especially are all very recognized and well known for grain, right? For food, for the breadbasket is Ukraine, right? So is that an
Right. Okay.
encroachment into the West of their
No,
logistical
I, yeah.
sustenance?
I think it's not so much the areas that people are awakening, because you see that awareness spreading all over the planet. I was just
Okay.
yesterday, I was on three different Zoom calls, three different areas of the world where people were organizing common law republics and working towards July when we're holding an international convention of people from all these different countries to try to convene a federation of common law republics, kind of our answer to the corporatocracy, right? But
Including Russia and
what
China.
it there's groups in Finland and Russia and Sweden who are organizing something there as well. Yeah, definitely.
Great to
But
hear.
you're right about the resources, and it's all about resources, you know. But in terms of the cliques, it's not they're not ultimately governed by the secret societies. It's kind of like saying to people, go to, do the elites go to church? they use religion and these different things as ways to simply mask their real intention and to keep people afraid. You know, it's part of that whole thing. I'm not saying those things don't go on, but it's not the primary factor here. If Trudeau went over to see, quote, the Queen, it was to let her know what's going on and to get the official sanction of the crown to legitimate the Chinese takeover in the West Coast. No doubt that that's what they had to do formally by the, you know, by their rules. She's got to sign off, right?
Right. Also to perhaps throw a bit of PR towards the royalists in Canada, right?
Yeah, anything to distract. I mean, that's the point. And the Chinese, they're adept in Sun Tzu and the art of war. They know exactly how to divide and conquer their adversaries. They're using Russia now. Russia is going to think that there will be an alliance. Frankly, what I see 50, 100 years down the road is that China will take over North America. Don't forget the entire Pacific Rim and the Indo-Pacific region. That's where the world economy is now growing the quickest. And China will dominate that whole Pacific Rim. Russia will be on the margins, and eventually they'll come to war. I think Europe and Russia are going to have to unite eventually as America goes down. And kind of the main opposition China will face half a century from now. But that's somewhat speculative, but I think it's based on the direction things are going now. And don't forget the overarching umbrella will be the corporatocracy, in which there are no nations. There are no religions or ideologies. They're just everyone serving that machine, right?
And so there's certain, you know, variables, weapons, you might say, but there's certain infrastructural levers and mechanisms that they have at their disposal, economics being one of them. And so with this sort of division that they're creating, contriving with, Russia and the West, with this Ukrainian situation, it feels to me that there's a pressure and a panic for them to push things on faster than perhaps they'd like, because, you know, we end the COVID scare and immediately go to this Russian scare. And that in itself is right. creating a lot of question marks and suspicion with perhaps people who are just beginning their wake up journey or whatever, however you like to pitch it. But these levers and mechanisms are creating inflation, creating food hikes, price hikes, this kind of thing, and so that creates more tension and pressure, you know, just amongst the regular public, and that then, you know, creates that emotional, you know, you come out of the higher mind into the limbic system, and people are therefore more manipulatable, pliable, in terms of propaganda,
right?
So over on the west coast of the North America, we've actually got an invasion by China. Why under the guise of the Russian propaganda machine, and so how aware are people over there with you of that, and is there a response mounting?
Well, like any frontline situation, people in British Columbia don't want to be aware. The evidence is right in front of them. And we've been dealing this for years. I mean, as you know, that's where I did so much of my work. And you can put the evidence in front of people and it doesn't make any difference. You know, you can have Chinese tanks in the streets of Vancouver and they still will be in denial about it. But although that won't be necessary because they already own the whole place. They don't need to bring in tanks.
Okay.
The important thing, though, is that it's just a stepping stone to the takeover of the whole continent. And that's, you know, I mean, when you look at what's going on in America, when Trump gets appointed in 2024, it'll be outright civil war at that point. And they're getting ready now. Like, I've got a lot of people and friends and family all over America, and they're telling me all these very ominous signs of, arming of both sides. The Republicans and Democrats, they're arming for a civil war. It's right on the verge of exploding. That's all being done with Chinese money and lobbying and political pressure and everything, because they can then step in and pick up the pieces. You can see that'll happen. It's kind of a fait accompli, I think. So the real question now is, what do we create out of the ashes? Is there anything that's going to be left for us to hold up, you know, the alternative, which, you know, we don't expect the Republic to be a working alternative now, but it's a seed of an idea that down the road people will revive again when they see what's happening, right?
Well, Biden's a massive asset in that, right? Because he's you know, a senile madman criminal, to say the least, right? So I actually saw some defensive battlements, it looked like, being built outside the White House in Washington, perhaps in preparation for these truckers, it seemed quite low key. I didn't hear much about what happened with the Washington trucker situation, but because Biden is such a calamitous leader, you know, you think he'll get to 2024 before the Trump situation arrives. So this is the patriotic for people over here that perhaps aren't quite up to date with it. So Trump galvanizes the patriots, the constitutional crowd, and Biden is a globalist.
Well, that's the impression they're trying to create. Okay, but don't forget, this is just an impression. Trump is no more allied with the Patriot movement than Biden is. I mean, right. It's like lawyers in a court pretending to be fighting each other, right?
Sure, but from the divide and rule perspective, they want to create that civil war with, you know, Trump and the Patriots versus Biden and the globalists, right? But Trump is connected with Israeli Zionist banking money. No one has pumped more money into Israel than Trump, right?
Well, he's personal friends with two of the people we convicted in our criminal court, Emma Walmsley and Alfred Borla. They're big contributors to him. I mean, you just have to scratch the surface and you see who's running who, right? But what, like I mentioned, the civil war is going to be overt. There's going to be out-and-out military conflict, and people are already arming for that now. And that's why the war had to happen so quick, because, you know, create a massive distraction. I did a survey online of the New York Times. Originally, in the first section, about 80% of the coverage was about COVID until before the war. Now about 80% is about the Ukraine war. Right. COVID vanishes.
It's a media switch.
No, it's classic Big Brother technique. And so the real question is there people who see through that and don't get caught up in this typical bipolar good evil civil war scenario that's been created? There are no good guys and bad guys. There's this thing we're all part of, which is coming apart. And there's this tyranny being created that the people in charge of that are trying to create an unassailable thing that will never be able to be taken out. And they have the technology now to do that. That's the reality here. I'm reading one of these points in Sun Tzu and the Art of War. There can be no reliable defense in war. Any defensive posture invites attack. So that's exactly how Putin is thinking right now. He says, if we stay defensive here and they come right into the Ukraine, we're inviting them to come in and take all of Russia, right? And NATO has to do that because NATO/America is in their death throes. They know America's going down, and they're striking out in panic and fear, and China's exploiting both of them. China's manipulating both of them to gain the upper hand. That's kind of the general situation we're in. But, you know, nothing's written in stone. I mean, there can be a lot of unforeseen things that happen, and that depends on all of us, right?
Right. So you think that China are pulling the global strings of Russia and the West?
Where did COVID come out of? Where is most of the corporatocracy's main funds now located in the Asian world? Right. Follow the money, but also it's just obvious from looking at what's going on. If you get outside the blinkers of what we're always being fed, you know, even to talk about countries now is probably redundant. That's not the way it's devolving,
right?
At all, right?
We're getting to continental stage, right? And so that's how does, from your perspective, how does the banking situation fit in? You know, with regards to we've spoken about the Vatican money, but also Zionist Israeli, you know, banking networks, they're drifting over towards China as a hub, as a base, and leaving the West, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, the West is not a factor anymore, really. not in terms of the progression of it. Most of the money in the world goes through the Vatican Bank and the Bank of International Settlements in Geneva, including the Israeli money. It's all being pumped through there. But now that money is all going to China, like we've talked about that before. But, you know, what the thing to remember about all this is that we only see what we're allowed to see, right? And we've got to use our own experience, our own knowledge on the ground. I was just talking to a group of people who, on one of my Zoom calls, this is a group of naturopaths who are trying to create an alternative to the healthcare system, but they don't have any understanding of what they're operating in. They're thinking in all the old terms. And so we said to them, well, look, if we don't create something now as an alternative, there's not going to be anything in 10 years, right? That's the way things are rapid. It's going exponentially now. And to expect people to try to create something out of the blue, I don't know. People don't react naturally that way. They're always looking to the old, right? Something from the past that they can rely on. And that's why, you know, what we're doing now, it's certainly going uphill. It's going against the stream, but it's essential to be creating those alternatives now, because that's the only seed we'll have in the future, right?
And economics for me seems a real flashpoint where we are. You know, everybody, you listen to the financiers, they're talking about this inflation and the price hikes and, you know, the food and logistics, as we've mentioned already. And so that area of trade and barter and economics, that's right on our doorstep, right? This is within the next 6 to 12 months that's going to have a huge shift, right?
Right. But, you know, again, it goes back to the whole question, what we mean when we say people are awake. I think it's an inaccurate term, because we haven't awoken. That we only awake when we're engaged with something and we lose something in a big way and we have to fight. Because I think the act of fighting and resistance is what really awakens us, right? You know, we talked about that before, where people can sit in a room and have all sorts of different ideas and do a Zoom call. Anything can be true, right? But you know what's true when something strikes you. You know the reality when, as you experienced, you're locked away, right? You know the nature of the state when it comes down on you, right? Yeah. And at that point, it becomes a very practical issue. I remember in history when, right after Hitler took power, all the churches in Germany were on board with him, Catholic, Protestant, they were all 90%. But there was a splinter group called the Confessing Church. These were German pastors who basically said, look, Hitler's the Antichrist. He's replacing the cross with the swastika, the Bible with Mein Kampf, and we have to actively resist. But how they started wasn't in overt resistance. They began as a support network among clergy who were married to Jews or partial Jews. So, and they were thrown out of their jobs because of it. They started as a support network, a defense response to that. And out of that came a whole underground movement that eventually was part of the assassination attempts on Hitler. But they began from a defensive reaction, and that's what we all do. I mean, we respond to, how can I protect myself? And then when you realize that ultimately you can't, you got to think bigger. You got to think beyond that to, how do we replace this? How do we effectively fight? And I think that's really the issue now, not so much how we interpret world events, which can have multiple interpretations, but what I see missing right now is the will and the courage to actually fight. You know, that doesn't seem, I'm speaking largely from Canada and the US, but, and there's exceptions to that, but by and large, people don't know how to, because they haven't had to. They've lived in a system with a lot of fat on it. And they don't know what it means to fight back. So that's a skill we need to acquire quickly under fire, right?
Well, there's what's brewing is resentment, fury, anger, this kind of thing, because the infrastructure is clearly being, you know, dismantled and destroyed. You know, particularly in the US, I hear the gas prices are massive already, and with these sort of continental splits arriving, you know, that price hike and the cost of living and the belt tightening and the difficulty of day to day existence is about to change in a big way. So that recognition of who the enemy is. This is what they're doing, right? This is why they're saying, hey, look over there to Ukraine, because there's your enemy. You know, Putin is the new virus. He's the madman, you know, the new, you know, right, bogey character that the media's throwing at people. But I don't think everybody's buying that. I think there's a healthy percentage who are asking, you know, good questions. And so that sort of framing of who to fight, you know, who is the enemy is the big question. And so, you know, perhaps people aren't where you are in terms of recognizing that there's this stealth invasion that's fully, in place and the infrastructure's there from China. But they're asking the questions, right? There's a lot of healthy questions about what the hell's going on. Oh, yeah.
No, I don't say that doesn't go on, but people can only do that for so long. I found this just personal examples over the years working with Aboriginal people. Like, they'll be sitting in a healing circle, and they all know the problem. They all live through it, but they're all incapacitated by fear, almost every one of them.
By fear.
And they don't know what to do, right? Fear. And yeah, they have a lot of awareness. I mean, they went through it. They know what they're dealing with. And because they're so aware, they don't want to fight it. They've got too much knowledge. They've got too much experience of the nature of this thing, knowing it can crush them in an instant if it wanted to. All they do is hide. You know, survivors hide, including in their own mind. They hide from themselves. And they tell themselves a lot of lies. Well, I see that going on in an analogous way. Among long, you know, you look at non-Native people in the mainstream culture, and that they're in a state of trauma still, but they have a lot of knowledge, you know, but they're saying, well, what do we do with it? And when we say, okay, well, we've got to start passing our own laws, enforcing them, creating another power pole to bring people out of the system, they won't. They just refuse. And that's not pessimistic. That's our experience. They would rather find a piece of security rather than resist. And I think that's the real issue we have to deal with, because if that doesn't change, there isn't a future, right?
And therein it lies the choice that, you know, that they have, you know, the people you're talking about, is that perhaps it's a better choice to, you know, take the government handout money and live in the way that they, you know, prescribe for us to live, so that they don't send, you know, the cops over to beat us up, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. But this is what's arriving for me is that between the rock and the hard place, where, you know, it's encroached into people's sustenance. You know, the base level of Maslow's pyramid, shelter, food, water, is about to get majorly affected. And so it's back to the wall, last chance, the saloon. And, you know, this is the wound, the dangerous, the beast, right, that, you know, is going to jump because it's cornered.
Well, in theory, yeah. I mean, I don't see it happening, but that can change. You know, I know in history that can change quickly overnight. People can flip. So I'm not discounting that. I'm speaking more of, like, the way I put it to the group last night, the conscious people are a small wheel, and the masses of people are a big wheel, but you need a middle wheel of people willing to organize, to set up alternatives, to be the clerk of the court, to be the sheriff, to actively say, my life is now devoted to this. And without that devotion and a new set of priorities in your life, that middle wheel doesn't exist, and you're going to smash yourself against the big wheel and be ineffective. And so all of the effort of the state is to wipe out that middle wheel all the time, right? To say, no, you don't need this assembly. If you join the Republic, you're going to get arrested. That's what scared off a lot of our people on the West Coast, that rumor that was put in by operatives, right? Kevin Annett is going to is making money off you, and, you know, all these lies to get people afraid, and you'll get arrested if you join his assembly. And so, you know, they knock out that middle wheel, and the minority is just sitting here ineffective. And on that point you said about the government paying money to people, just as a side point, in Canada, they just announced, oh, you know how we said that we were going to give you $2,000 every month, tax-free and everything? Well, you have to pay it back now if you don't get the shot. If you don't get the shot, you have to pay back all that money.
And what's the result of that going to be? Well, it's going to be people getting entrenched more in that position of nothing left to lose. You know, it's backs to the wall. Maybe. We've got to fight, right?
Yeah. Maybe 1 out of 10 might have that reaction. And we're looking for those 1 out of 10. We're trying to organize them all the time. But I was just doing that with a group in Ontario, and they said, okay, we got to take action, but look at everybody around us. Who do we appeal to? There's nobody to appeal to. They're all in that state of helplessness. But again, it's not the cop out there. It's the cop in their head, the voice in their head, which is preventing them from risking and taking the next step. And, you know, I say, look, are you willing to die for this? because I don't mean that in a melodramatic way, but if your life is on the line and you know you can't do anything, you fight that much harder. You have nothing to lose. I mean, I had that experience over the last while when I had all these health issues, right? And I was seriously thinking, okay, so there's a chance I'm being targeted chemically, electronically. That's a very possibility. I've got four different health issues now in my body. So all the more reason to fight. I want to make every day count. That's what it evokes in me. But that isn't an immediate response in people. You have to have lost a lot often in your life to get to that point. Or maybe your character is different. I don't know, but it's hard to say with different people. But that's what we have to appeal to, that capacity in people to say, to hell with it. This is my fight now to the death. We're in this to the death. And when you get people like that, that's when you become a threat to the system. And then, you know, then it goes a whole new level. But I mean, we're gradually getting there, but it goes one step forward, two steps back all the time, right?
On your health, could, if it's not too personal a point, can we get an update? Your stones settled down. Is that right?
Well, no, the stone is still there. It's holding in the same size, and it's lobbed. It's lodged in the lower lobe of the left kidney. It's just kind of sitting there. In a way, that's the least of my problems, because I've had a return of the skin infection I had. This is Staphylococcus infection, just keeps recurring all the time. The hearing problem is getting worse, almost permanent hearing loss in my left ear. And now I've been diagnosed with eye issues having to do with probable borderline glaucoma, which kind of came out of the blue. Now, glaucoma is caused by increasing pressure in the eye, which stops the fluid from draining. And then a lot of pressure builds up on the eye, and you can go blind from it unless you're treated. But all of this is kind of hit me right out of the blue last fall. And it was definitely an attack. And so I say to people, look, it doesn't matter if I die tomorrow or a year from now or 10 years from now. What matters is what we do in the next moment, the next hour. Every day, it's kind of switching your priorities and being devoted to this and not dabbling in it, which people feel they can have all their old life and then dabble in this stuff. It doesn't change anything. It doesn't do anything when you operate it out of that way of thinking, right?
So that last fall, when you feel like you had an attack, do you have any ideas about where that might have happened, or how it sounds to me very much like EMF, electromagnetic frequency. Canberra in Australia, I don't know if you saw that, but there's a lot of injuries along those lines, the symptoms you're talking about, where they had evidence of the police firing these sonic weapons at the crowds, right?
I've been living off the radar a lot. I've been living on different safe houses, but nothing's infallible. It's easy to track someone. I'm surprised when it didn't happen to me a lot sooner. But under the general climate, I think it's a lot easier to take people out now, because people are so afraid and for themselves that, you know, they don't care as much anymore. They're just kind of cowering in their own holes and they don't want to come out. I find that with a lot of people that they're there now, you know, in that state of mind. So, I mean, yeah, it's conceivable that could be going on, but I don't even focus on that. I focus on just keeping my spirits up and focused every day to allow me to do the work I've got to do, right?
I completely agree. I think if they've got such a kill grid set up, you know, with electromagnetic frequencies, if they want to just, you know, what's it called? Combust us in a moment. I think they've got the technology to do that. The reason they don't want to do that is because of the wake up factor that would bring. You know, there's a couple of very peculiar looking deaths that have happened with regards to people in cars exploding and this kind of thing. So I think that's you're exactly right. That if they wanted to, they could, but they don't want to because of the consequences, right?
Yeah, it's too much. Light being shone on. If something happened to me, a lot of people would set up and take notice, and the interest in my work would increase again. Why would they hand that to us, right? Yep. It's also the fact we've talked about this before, but you know, the adversary, you know, so to speak, they're just people like us placed in a different situation. You know, any of us can be doing that. If we're placed in a different situation, circumstance in our life, we could be on the other side. The way human beings rationalize things to each other and to themselves. So those human beings on the other side who are doing all this stuff, they know it's wrong. Somewhere inside themselves, it's that kind of, you know, that expression, worm of conscience. It's digging away, winding its way through them. And they secretly have a death wish. They want it to come down. I experienced this in the United Church in a big way. They were the very clergy who were destroying my life were relying on me to bring out the truth about something they didn't want to bring out themselves, but they knew it had to come out. The whole thing about the mass murder of Native children. It still weighs on the conscience of those people, but they can breathe a sigh of relief because now they say, oh, we've acknowledged it. So they almost use that as the way to continue in their own illusion. And the same thing is happening with the COVID thing. So I think, don't forget, this is ultimately just about people and very messed up people, but we can appeal to that all the time. Hearts and minds, keep the moral high ground, right?
You said they were relying on you to blow the whistle and to disclose all this. How do you mean relying? That's interesting. This is at a subconscious level, right?
Yeah. I had experience of that. When, for example, the one of the first hearings they had in the United Church to basically tell me I had to come around or I'll face defrocking and all that. I had to do all these things. I said, you know, this is about crimes we did. We have to face it. And I remember one fairly senior official said, of course we will, but all in good time when it will have minimum impact on us. And I said, so if you know that, then why are you going after me now? And he said, for appearance sake. He was remarkably disclosing. He said, for appearance sake, because it's better to scapegoat one person at the time. And, you know, let's say they came out when I talked about and I show them all the evidence of genocide in the residential schools. And then if they all brought that out all at once, everyone would leave the church and would collapse. Right. And yet they couldn't. They had to feed it in pieces. So you get rid of the whistleblower. He's allowed the issue to be addressed without any harm to them. And then they can parcel out information in stages to acclimatize people. It's called inoculation in public relations. Okay. You inoculate the people with bits and pieces, and finally you can talk about the whole thing and no one will care because they've gradually normalized the genocide. And this is what's going on now. It's so normal out there now to wear masks that, you know, there's not even an issue anymore, right, in people's mind. It's become part of the way. It's really like an identification badge of, yes, you can experiment on me, I'm wearing this muzzle. But that had to come in stages, just like the genocide thing did. So it's that process of normalization, and we have to know how we're being used. And I had to learn that over time. But you just don't feed their energy into their system anymore. That's the main way we prevent being used, according to an agenda we don't even know about. Keep your own identity and move in another direction out of the system, and they have to run after you. I mean, we proved that in Canada, right, with our campaign.
Well, with a net run after you to pull you back into it.
No, they have to run after us to copy what we're doing, but on their terms, right? I mean, Trudeau uses the word genocide now. We were the only ones using that word 15 years ago. Now they're using it. You see, they have to try to capture the language, but they're changed in the process too. Right. It's like culture. It's porous. It goes in two directions all the time. We're in that joint codependency with the people we're fighting. Right.
That it's normalizing it. Right. So the word genocide, if the prime minister is using it, then, you know, that's OK, because, you know, if there was a problem, he would have done something about it. See, I've just been doing quite a lot of child protection stuff with the family courts. So I don't like to call them that. Let's call them someone else. But similarly with that scenario, all these children are getting, you know, ripped out of the arms of mothers and fathers, you know, parents. And that's normal, right? That's been going on for so many decades now that you try and address that with somebody and they'll say, yeah, you know, that the social services take children, put them in foster cares, homes. And that's just what happens. You know, why are you so upset about that? And that normalization, you know, how do you shatter the ice?
It's the dead eye. It's the dead hand of the machine. Okay. So genocide isn't children being beaten to death and tortured to death and their bodies rotting in the ground somewhere, or somebody taking his life 10 years later because he can't stand it. you know, all these, the visual reality of what it is, it's all sanitized out by the word. Language sanitizes, you know, child protection. It sanitizes rape and torture and child trafficking, all this horrible shit, right? So we have to put a human face on that again. That's how we've brought about change in Canada on this whole thing of, and again, genocide is a dead word. You know, it's Greek, a Greek word, you know, like what does it mean to most people? Most people don't even know what the term means. So we always say, okay, so the torture of children, here's how they were tortured. Here's how they're still tortured. Imagine a child being held down and have drugs shoved in their arm to test out a drug and then have their skin disintegrate or their eyes fall out or their hair fall out at age 4, right? Because of drug testing that Pfizer and GlaxoSmithKline and Novartis and others are still doing as we speak to people in hospitals. Well, three of the people we did detain on Vancouver Island, they pointed out one of these mass grave sites where people killed in drug testing experiments were buried as recently as 2019. So, I mean, this stuff is happening right now. And when people realize that, they go, my God, I could be next, right? We just can't let this go on anymore. But so that's why they always talk about things in the past.
It frightens them, right? And they kind of cripple because of the fear aspect.
To a point, but then the reverse happens and they get, suddenly they just go, whoa, I can't, this has got to stop, all right? And it's up to me to do something. I've seen that change happen in people, right? And it's unpredictable how it happens. It just happens as it will. But the point is you have to be always telling the visual truth to people. And it's not something in the past. It's not something far away. It's immediate in our neighborhood, right? And here's what it looks like.
When I was in my early 20s, after I finished college, I got a couple of jobs, advertising and sales promotion. It sort of springs to mind that, you know, that's what we got to do. We got to find almost a new razzmatazz way of, in inverted commas, selling truth to the masses. It sounds so weird.
No, I think I think that's the problem is that truth is seen as a commodity. Truth is seen something you have to impose on people and convince them of. You don't have to convince anyone of the truth. They already know what it is. I know what you're saying, but you don't use their methods because all that's designed, that's based on a contempt of people that they don't have the ability to figure things out. They do. It's just that they're too busy and too frightened and too unaware of what's going on to really work it through for themselves. That'll change, though. That changes as things break down and people have to start asking questions. And that's what you referred to earlier by the waking up process, right?
Right. And so then the media, again, comes into play in a big way. For me, it's the number one battlefront that we're at. And so you see the deterioration, the corrosion, if you like, of such as the BBC, you know, the popularity and the viewing figures, they're plummeting, right, in a big way. So people are looking to other areas and other places, media platforms, perhaps is the phrase. And that's quite exciting for me because there are options. You know, we got a platform over here called Iconic, which is, you know, gathering a lot of momentum. But then there's the whole business aspect of that platform where you think to yourselves, well, are they, you know, trying to hit as many people as possible from a money perspective and then not going quite as far as they might with regards to the content of what they're publicizing? So it's swings and roundabouts, isn't it?
Yeah. I couldn't figure out when I first began to get, you know, we all go through stages of naivety, right? And if you get hit enough and you learn from your experience, then you change. But you know, I wondered early on, hey, I've got all of these eyewitness testimonies of these crimes. We've got the records. We've got even forensic evidence from graves. How come none of the alternative media are reporting any of this?
Right. You go what a story.
To them, you give it to them. Okay. So that's because the alternative media are heavily targeted by the state. They're either funded by them or influenced by them, or the news agencies they rely on are controlled themselves by the corporatocracy. The one I love is, I don't know if you know Sun Oil Company. It's called Sunoco. It's a big gas company in America. Well, they're the ones who run the green movement in America. They run a thing called the Pew Foundation. And Greenpeace and all these organizations are funded by them. And so when we were working with some of the people on the West Coast trying to stop the last of the logging of the old growth, Greenpeace said, no, I'm sorry, we can't be involved in that campaign. Why? because the Pew Foundation would cut off their funds because Sun Oil Company told them not to fund that because obviously they had investments in the logging of the big timber. So things are controlled in ways we don't understand. And the litmus test is when you have evidence that really damns the system and nobody will touch it, that's the proof of where their allegiance is, right? Because why wouldn't they report it, right?
Well, it's the corporate headset, right? Oh, we got to, you know, put food on our tables. We've got to feed our children, da, da, da. So we'll choose our market share, you know, our target audience. And there is that target audience of, you know, lightweight truthers or whatever you want to call them. Right. And so we'll hit them with, you know, a couple of things here and there, you know, Trudeau's a bastard and this kind of thing. But we're not going to go nearly as far as we might go because then we'll lose that corporate sponsorship.
And a matter of fact, there was I've got to find the reference, but there was a study done by corporations back in the 70s about how to deal with dissent aimed at their company. And they said they very accurately, they had sociologists map the kind of people who protest. And they said, by and large, the bulk of people are moderates. They want change and reform, but they don't want a revolution. They don't want to overthrow the system. They just want alterations. But on the one end, you've got the revolutionaries, the ones who recognize that all of these crimes are coming from the same source, and that source has to be replaced. It's, you know, you need to overhaul the whole system. This corporate strategy is to isolate the revolutionary minority from the masses of protesters. Okay. And the way you do that is by offering bribes all the time. You say to them, come on in and we'll consult you or here. But, you know, don't listen to these radicals like Kevin Annett over there who want to bring down the system. You'll be in danger. That's exactly how they took out our Republican assemblies on the West Coast. So it's the isolation of the aware minority from the rest. That's their key, right?
And it's carrot and stick, as well as that sort of bribery aspect you mentioned. There's also the stick. So the anti-vaxxers is quite an interesting one at the moment, right? Nobody wants to be an anti-vaxxer because you can feel that there's a persecution job being done on those people. So you know, even people who, you know, never had a vaccine in their life or injection in their life, they still don't want to be labeled an anti-vaxxer, even though pretty much they are an anti-vaxxer because of the stigma of the label, right? Energizing words like we spoke of last week.
Well, I think it's so funny when you look back 10, 20 years about in the culture, there was such a thing about how drug addicts and drug pushers are so horrible, right? And now the state is the biggest drug pusher around, and suddenly that's okay to do that, right? These Orwellian flips that can happen is just mind-boggling. It's part of the disorientation we all feel, like, what the hell is going on? Which is kind of like, I don't know if you've ever been in a fight. I got into my first fight when I was 10, and when this kid was beating me up, your first reaction to being assaulted is not fear. It's confusion, like, what's going on? Why me? There must be something wrong. Just confusion. And then that state of disorientation is when you can really grab people's minds. So they got to keep beating you up all the time, beating you up, right? And when you start to find ways of resisting that mentally, it means that you don't react anymore. I say in the whistleblower manual that action reaction is the energy of a slave. There's an act and they react to it. But action maneuver is the response of a conscious man or woman. When they do something, you don't react to it. You maneuver on your own terms and use that energy to your advantage. And those are two different, totally, when you look at the truckers protest or any protest going on, it's action reaction, stimulus response. They know exactly how to stimulate people to get the response they want, right? But they don't, what they couldn't figure out is when they acted and then we responded by putting it back on them and forcing change on our terms, including the Pope out of office, right? That's something they don't know how to deal with. And yet it's frustrating so much, Owen, because the lessons are right there. It's so simple to learn, but people keep rejecting that because we're so conditioned into the action, reaction, stimulus, response.
Your chapter in that book is go for the jugular, right? And that's the last thing they expect from a, you know, an individual or a small group of people, to go for the global corporatist boom. And so then you get, you know, I spoke about the limbic system early on. So you got the higher mind, when you're cool and calm and collected, you accessing all aspects of your consciousness. Then you get nervous and frightened and traumatized, and you regress into the limbic system, which is very emotional reaction, right? And then you've got that, reptilian fight flight, and then there's two others, and one of them made me think of just a second ago. So as well as fight and flight, you've got freeze, which is, you know, like you're saying, do absolutely nothing. but also fawn, right? Which is basically a sort of ass kissing, right?
Right. Well, you see that in the animal kingdom all the time, right? Animals falling down and presenting themselves like that. Yeah, those are all wired into us. That's a really interesting thing, you know? And people who think they're in conscious control of their own minds aren't really, because they've got those responses keyed in. So it takes a lot of self-awareness to even find a way to even manage that somehow, right? Rather than not you know, only overcome it, but how on a day-to-day basis do we deal with this, right?
Yeah, and that fawning is very much what we're relying on, I think. Right? They're quite happy for freeze, you know, if people just completely go numb and do absolutely nothing. But that fawning is what, you know, if that were to switch to fight, everything would change, I think. You know, that backs to the wall, last chance saloon. Oh my God, they've come into my backyard now and I can't afford to feed my children. Well, what's response is that going to evoke? Is it going to be, you know, kiss ass and hope that you can get food? Or is it going to be, you know, just do nothing because you just sit down and watch TV or something because you don't know what to do? Or is it going to be fight? And this is what, you know, is arriving, right? There are fighters coming out of the woodwork now.
Okay, but again, to use another analogy from history, all of these films of thousands of people lining up to go into the cattle cars and they're guarded by two soldiers. Okay, they could crush those two soldiers in an instant. How come they don't? Because they're all thinking of their personal safety and they're all believing we can't be, they wouldn't wipe us out. You know, they need us economically. Like, this doesn't make any sense. So the disbelief and the fear keeps two able to control 10,000, right? Those who resisted, like in the Warsaw Ghetto Uprising, they were already organized. They already had an underground structure. They're already revolutionaries. They saw it coming for a long time, and they were prepared. And you know what the very first thing the Jewish resistance in the Warsaw Ghetto did? They didn't shoot Nazis. They assassinated the heads of the Jewish Elders Organization. You see, these were the Jewish elders who collaborated, picked out all the people in the ghetto who were to be shipped out. They killed them all.
Traitors.
Well, not just because they were traitors, they were the false leadership, and you couldn't have your leadership divided. You had to get rid of any kind of distraction, collaborating distraction, and be fighting to the death. And they assassinated the top leaders of the Jewish Elders Council, and then they could take up arms, but not before then. By analogy today, you know, I think the analogy is pretty obvious, right?
Well, it makes me think straight away that, you know, the truckers are heading to Washington and Ottawa to do exactly that, to get rid of the fake leader. You know, the apples is the other one too, right? Once you clear out the phony Iagos from the leadership situation, then things become much more efficient, right?
Well, unfortunately, that's not their aim, to get rid of the false leaders. Their aim is to, again, appeal, is to do the fawning, is to say, please don't remove the measures. Like, I don't know if you saw those press conferences of the truckers in Canada. They were appealing to the prime minister as if he's the one who mattered, right? And appealing to this criminally convicted felon to do the right thing. By analogy, it'd be like the Jews going to the Nazis saying, please don't bomb the ghetto, please. Yeah. And then be shot, right? I mean, that's not what they're doing. And that's the critical issue now, is the lack of that leadership to lead an independent struggle. That's what we're lacking. And that's really what I think we need to focus on, how to build that leadership.
Well, that comes from good communication first up, right? And we're really on the back foot with regards to communication, because we're using the enemy's infrastructure to communicate.
That's right. So there can be no clarity. As long as we rely on the internet, as long as we use their operating their bailiwick, we'll be continually confused, and you won't be able to cohere a clear thinking leadership. That's what Sun Tzu says. The success of a battle depends on the clarity and the will of the commander or the leadership body. Clarity and will. And we both are lacking right now. And that's what we try to do all the time, provide clarity about, you know, what we're in, what we're facing, what we need to do all the time. And that's what I spend most of my time now working with people, to help solidify that core, right?
We spoke a couple of weeks ago about one of the problems with our enemy system, our opponent's adversary system, is that they have too rigid a leadership structure. Whereas one of our strengths is that we don't have that, obvious chain of command hierarchical leadership structure. So how does that fit in with what we just spoke about, with the problem that we don't have leadership?
Right. I didn't mean a leadership in the sense of a massive national body. Okay. That's right. The last thing we want, because it can be easily infiltrated and destroyed. That's happened to me on 4 different occasions and movements I was helping set up over the years.
With guerrillas.
You need that. Yeah. You need the solid leadership, but in a very localized way. Every local common law assembly or cell group or group working needs that leadership. The way we do it is this. When people want to join the Republic, we say you need to form a leadership cell, an LC we call it, a leadership cell of 3 people, a convener, a secretary treasurer, and a sheriff. And those 3 each go out and recruit 3 other people. And then you've got 12 eventually, and those 12 can form an assembly, sign a charter, right? But each of those cells is separate. And if one got taken out, the other wouldn't, right? And yet it's run by a central leadership cell that initially forms everything. So forming those leadership cells is key to starting moving the bigger wheel eventually, right? And that's what we do our training workshops and in that to form that. So you get a thousand of those brush fires forming all over, and they can't stamp it out, right? So that's kind of as opposed to their corporate hierarchy, where there really isn't leadership per se. It's just the machine itself creates the, Marcus Aurelius called it the hegemonicon, the group mind, the single mind governing everybody, right? So ours is the organic opposite, right?
Yeah. They have fear of themselves, though, true. I think that, one of the reasons why, guerrillas thrive or survive, at least, is because their our enemies, our opponents, our adversaries, decision making, they don't want to be the one that's isolated. So Trudeau, for example, is seemingly fairly isolated at the moment. I would imagine that's why he's trying to gain the support of the monarchy over here. This kind of stuff is because a lot of people, even his own parliamentarians, I think, are stabbing him in the back now because they feel that public pressure on him. And so because he's almost taken a step too far as an individual outside of the hegemonicon, and people can now, individually pinpoint
that's
him
like
as
Putin.
That's
what New York Times is saying about Putin. He's overstepped himself. He's isolated. He's going to be brought down. Part of that is just the same old distraction. But yeah, the purpose of hand puppets like Trudeau or Putin or anybody is that they're expendable. They can be removed, right. And then it's the old Chinese system. You throw an unpopular minister to the crowd every year,
and they know that,
and they vent their anger on the one person, and then the emperor keeps ruling, right?
They know that themselves, right? They don't want to take too many risks because they will get shoved out, as that scapegoat thrown to the wolves. And you see it with the COVID situation, where the politicians are passing the buck over to the medical team, and the medical team are saying, no, well, we've covered our asses here, and it's the media that's doing it. They're all passing the buck, right? And it's a case of picking apart the infrastructure so that the individuals have got nothing to rest on, right?
But, it's like I say, it doesn't matter what they do. Our attention should not be on, quote, them. The attention has to be on what are we going to do among our own people. And most of, it's really interesting because we'll be having Zoom calls and people will agree to that. And then they'll say, yeah, but look what Putin's doing. And I say, look, stop that. Okay, stop it. You got to ignore them. They don't really matter. Ultimately, the matter is what matters is what we are going to do in the next moment. We could all die tomorrow. Really? This could be the last day of your life. What are you going to do with it? Not protest, not keep saying the obvious about all those people. It's what are we going to build right now in our communities and in myself that my descendants are going to be able to use in the future. So really, it's like trying to herd cats with people, but you've got to keep pushing them in that direction about look at our own task and not the so-called bad guys, right?
So you go back a few hundred years and you find, over here in Europe that there was a lot of people who realized that this was a non-tenable environment and infrastructure that they were living in. So they thought, right, what can we do? Let's start afresh. Let's cross the ocean and we'll go somewhere where, you know, pristine snow or whatever, and we'll start afresh from anew. But then the problems or the enemies or the hegemonicon followed them over and infiltrated and destroyed, you know, their good ideas, right? Similarly with the child protection stuff I'm in at the moment, right. You know, there's families and individual mothers, parents who they want to get on with their lives. They want to, you know, ignore the adversaries, the opponents, the enemies, but they keep encroaching into their lives, right? So, you know, we talked at the beginning about identifying the enemy and how difficult that is. And these individuals that are representing the psychopathy, the hegemonicon, they need resisting, right? Repelling, fighting.
Okay, but here's how we fight. By not attacking, but do taking back power. That's the first step, take back power. So the example you used of the Puritans in America, the Puritan remnant that came over to America, they created the American Republic because they wrote the first constitution in history. It said we in the Plymouth, in the Mayflower Compact, it says we are forming a civil government, we the people. And they couched it in very religious terms. But the point is that was the model for the American Republic right there. Boom, the seed. Now, the fact that their opulence and their empire and all that corrupted it, that's the cycle of history. That'll always happen. That's why Thomas Jefferson said you need a revolution every 25 years, people. Yeah. You've got to revolt in your own mind and thinking and throw them all out. It's like nature. You need to replenish all the time, right? Revolution is your birthright. And you have to act on it or you'll live in tyranny. It's that simple. So that's the message now. And I know we've only got like, 10 minutes left here, but I really want to leave people with that message that we have to continually create it. It's like this permanent revolution in ourselves and right now. And in terms of the child protection thing, well, you don't rely on the system. You've got to set up the alternative safeguards so that you can pull your kids out of the system. Yep. And that's the hard thing to teach people, but we got to build that, right?
So with that 25-year regular revolution, how about a debt reset? I heard that in some Arabic countries, I think it's maybe even 7 years, they just wipe all debt and start afresh.
That's the Jubilee laws in the Old Testament. And it's interesting. That's a great topic for another show because Jubilee economics says all debts are canceled routinely. The land has to be replenished. The way farmers let their field lie fallow every third year to allow it to regenerate, the economy has got to be the same way. You level the differences. And it's interesting because when in the Bible, when Jesus gets up in the synagogue and he announces what he's doing for the first time, he says, I'm bringing in the Jubilee year. And then they try to kill him. They take him out and try to throw him off a cliff for doing that, right? He creates this uproar because the Jubilee said you cancel all debts. All land goes back to the original owners. All the differences are leveled. You open the prisons and let everybody out. That's really what Jesus, he was a revolutionary. That's what Christ was doing. He was wanting to bring in the Jubilee. And of course that threatened the Romans and the Pharisees, and all sorts of rich landowners. And that's why they killed them. But the point is that Jubilee vision is what we're talking about. Exactly the kind of program in a nutshell of a common law republic, right?
Was that the same incident where he smashed up the temple of the debt collectors?
That was at the end. At the start of his ministry, this is in the Matthew, Mark, and Luke, Synoptic Gospels, the early ones. He starts his ministry by causing a riot in his hometown in Nazareth, and they try to kill him. And he finishes it by trashing the money changers out of the temple in Rome and in Jerusalem with the Roman garrison right next door, active insurrection. And then immediately after that, he's crucified for doing it. But you see, all of his work, it's insurrectionary. It's saying to people, toss out these bastards. We don't need them. He said, I came to bring division, not peace. Right? I want to light the world on fire. Luke 12, I come not to bring peace, but division, to set brother against son, father against son, brother against brother. I want to set fire to the world. You know, he talks about that. So that's revolutionary talk, and yet somehow it gets kind of degraded into this thing called Christianity, right?
Right.
So, you know,
it's that dilution of that fervor and the salt, right? You mentioned the salt. Didn't he also talk about pulling the stone out of the temple so it all collapses?
We said, that was predicting his death. That was a lot of editing. Later, the church wrote this stuff into the Bible saying he was predicting his death and resurrection. He said, if you get rid of the stone, the whole temple is going to fall, but it will rise again. You've got to kind of separate the original saying from all the story around it that got added on later. But that kernel of the idea that nobody is your ruler, you can rule yourself. There's one authority, that's the Creator, and we're all equal within the Creator. I mean, it's this radical egalitarian message, and it's really our answer to the corporatocracy, which is the empire.